and he saw his soldiers. And feeling grief grip his heart, he forced himself to look from one face to the next. In his mind, he spoke their names. Tar, Coric, Bottle, Smiles, Balm, Throat Slitter, Dead Smell, Widdershins, Hellion, Herb, Limp, Crump, Sinter, Kissware, Maybe, Flashwit, Mayfly, Clasp, Nepfaro, Relico, Vastly Blank, Masangalani. "Where's Nefarious Bread?" he demanded. Sergeant Tar tilted his head. "Captain? Where is he, damn you?" "There is no Nefarious Bread, sir. We made him up on the march to Yagatan. Got us a bad loaf of bread. Someone called it Nefarious. We thought it was funny, like something Braven Tooth would have made up." He shrugged. "But I..." Fiddler turned to Hedge, saw the man's blank look. "Oh, never mind," he sighed, facing his soldiers again. "All of you, go down. Take sweet lard and rum jugs with you. I'll be down shortly." He watched them walk away. He knew their thoughts, the emptiness now overtaking them, which would in the days and nights ahead slowly fill with grief until they were all drowning. Fiddler looked back up at the sky. The jade strangers looked farther away. He knew that was impossible, too soon for that. Still, a faint wind swept across the summit, cool and dry. "Now," said Hedge. Fiddler thought he heard horses drawing up, and then three figures were climbing into view, ghostly, barely visible to his eyes. He could see through them all. Whiskey Jack, Trots, Mallet. "Oh, shit," said Callum, kicking at a discarded helm. It spun, rolled down the hillside. Whiskey Jack regarded him. "Got something to say, assassin?" And the man suddenly grinned. "It stinks, sir, from here to the throne." The ghost nodded, and then squinted westward for a moment before turning to Hedge. "Well done, soldier. It was a long way back. You ready for us now?" Fiddler felt something crumble inside him. Hedge drew off his tattered leather cap, scratched at the few hairs left on his mottled scalp. "That depends, sir." "On what?" Whiskey Jack demanded, eyes fixing hard on the sapper. Hedge glanced over at Fiddler. "On him, sir." And Fiddler knew what he had to say. "I let you go long ago, Hedge."
"Aye, but that was then, and this isn't. You want me to stay? A few more years, maybe? Till it's your time, I mean."
If he spoke at all, Fiddler knew that he would lose control, so he simply nodded. Hedge faced Whiskey Jack.
"Not yet, sir. Besides, I was talking with my sergeants just the other day about buying us a bar back in Malaz City. Maybe even Smiley's."
Fiddler shot the man a glare.
"But no one can find it, Hedge. Kellenved went and hid it. Kitty Corner to the Dead House, that's where it is. Everyone knows, Fid." "But they can't find it, Hedge."
The man shrugged.
"I will."
"Fiddler," Whiskey Jack said, "pay attention now. Our time is almost done here. Sun's soon to rise, and when it does, we will have left this world for the last time." He gestured and Mallet stepped forward, carrying a satchel. He crouched down and removed the straps, and then drew out a fiddle. Its body was carved in swirling bargast patterns. Seeing that, Fiddler looked up at Trots. The warrior grinned, showing his filed teeth.
"I did that, Fid. And that mistake there, up near the neck, that was Hedge's fault. He tugged my braid. Blame him, I do."
Mallet carefully set the instrument down, placing the bow beside it. The healer glanced up, almost shyly.
"We all had a hand in its making, Fid, us bridge burners."
"Take it," ordered Whiskey Jack. "Fiddler, you were the best of us all. You still are."
Fiddler looked over at Quick Ben and Callum, saw their nods, and then at Hedge, who hesitated as if to object, and then simply shrugged. Fiddler met Whiskey Jack's ethereal eyes.
Thank you, sir.
The ghost then surprised him by stepping forward, reaching down and touching the fiddle. Straightening, he walked past them to stand facing the lowland to the west. Fiddler stared after him, frowning. Sighing, Hedge spoke low at his side.
She's out there, assembled now. They're keeping their distance. They're not sure what's happened here. By the time she comes, it'll be too late.
Who? By the time who comes?
The woman he loves, Fid. Corlat. Tist Andy.
Tist Andy? Oh, no. Hedge's grunt was strained with emotion.
Aye. The sergeant's luck ain't never been good. He's got a long wait.
But wait he will. Then he caught a blur of motion from a nearby jumble of boulders, a woman watching them. Fiddler hugged himself, looked over once more at Mallet and Trotz.
Take care of him, he whispered.
They nodded, and then Whiskey Jack was marching past.
Time to leave, you two.
Mallet reached down and touched the fiddle before turning away. Trotz stepped past him, squatted, and did the same. Then they were down over the edge of the hill. Moments later, Fiddler heard horses, but in the gloom he could not see his friends riding away. A voice spoke beside Cotillion.
Well done.
The patron god of assassins looked down at the knives still in his hands.
I don't like failure. Never did, Shadow Throne.
Then,
and the ethereal form at his side giggled,
we're not quite finished, are we?
Ah, you knew then.
Of course, and this may well shock you, but I approve.
Cotillion turned to him in surprise.
I knew you had a heart in there somewhere.
Don't be an idiot. I just appreciate symmetry.
Together they turned back to face the barrow once again, but now the ghosts were gone. Shadow Throne thumped his cane on the ground.
Among all the gods, he said, who do you think now hates us the most?
The ones still alive, I should imagine.
We're not done with them either.
Cotillion nodded towards the barrow.
They were something, weren't they?
With them, we won an empire.
I sometimes wonder if we should ever have given it up.
Bloody idealist. We needed to walk away. Sooner or later, no matter how much you put into what you've made, you have to turn and walk away.
Shall we, then?
And the two gods set out, fading shadows as the dawn began to awaken. Tok Younger had waited astride his horse, halfway between the motionless ranks of the Guardians and Whiskey Jack and his two soldiers. He had watched the distant figures gathering on the barrow's gnarled summit, and now the three ghostly riders were returning the way they had come. When they reached him, Whiskey Jack waved Mallet and Trotz on, and then reined in. He drew his mount round to face the barrow one last time. Tok spoke.
That was some squad you had yourself there, sir.
My life was blessed with fortune.
It's time, he said, drawing his horse round. He glanced across at Tok.
Ready, bridge burner?
They set out side by side. And then Tok shot Whiskey Jack a startled look.
But I'm not a... You say something, soldier?
Mute Tok shook his head.
God's pillow. I made it.
In the luminescent sky high above the plain, Gorol sailed on the currents, wings almost motionless. The Shigal assassin studied the world far below. Scores of dragon carcasses were strewn round the barrow, and there, leading off into the west as far as Gorol's eyes could see, a road of devastation almost a league wide, upon which were littered the bodies of Elaint, hundreds upon hundreds. The Shigal struggled to comprehend the Otatarl dragon's ordeal. The flavors that rose within him threatened to overwhelm him. I still taste the echoes of her pain. What is it in a life that can prove so defiant, so resilient in the face of such willful rage? Carabas, do you crouch now in your cave, gift of a god wounded near unto death, closing about your wounds, your sorrow, as if in the folding of wings you could make the world beyond vanish? And with it all the hate and venom, and all that so assailed you in your so few moments of freedom? Are you alone once more, Carabas? If to draw close to you would not kill me, if I could have helped you in those blood-filled skies, upon that death-strewn road, I would join you now, to bring to an end your loneliness. But all I can do is circle these skies, above the ones who summoned you, who fought to free a god, and to save your own life. Those ones, too, I do not understand. These humans have much to teach the Kachain Chemal. I, Gorul, Shigal assassin of Gunthan Wandering, am humbled by all that I have witnessed, and this feeling, so strange, so new, now comes to me in the sweetest flavors imaginable. I did not know. Settling the last stone down on the elongated pile, Ikariam brushed dust from his hands and slowly straightened. Ublala, with Ralata sitting nearby, watched the warrior walk to the edge of the hill, watched as Ikariam dislodged a small rock and sent it rolling down the slope. And then he looked back at the barrow, and then at Ublala. The morning was bright, but there were clouds building to the east, and the wind carried the promise of rain.
It is as you said, friend?
Ublala nodded. Ikariam wiped at the tears still streaming down his face from when he'd wept over the grave. But the look on his face wasn't filled with grief anymore, just empty now, lost.
Ublala, is this all there is of me?
He gestured vaguely.
Is this all there is to any of us?
The Toblakai shrugged.
I am Ublala Pung, and that is all I ever am or was. I don't know if there's more. I never do.
Ikariam studied the grave again.
He died defending me.
Yes.
But I don't know who he was.
Ublala shrugged again. There was no shame in weeping for the death of a stranger. Ublala had done it many times. He reached down, picked up a potsherd, examined the sky-blue glaze.
Pretty,
he said under his breath, tucking it behind his belt. Ikariam collected up his weapons and then faced north.
I feel close this time, Ublala.
Ublala thought to ask close to what, but already he was confused, and so he put the question away. He didn't think he'd ever go back to find it. It was where all the other troubling things went. Never to be gone back to, ever.
I am glad you found a woman to love, friend, Ikariam said.
The giant warrior smiled over at Ralata and received a stony stare in return, reminding him how she'd said she liked it better when it was just the two of them. But she was a woman, and once he sexed her again, everything would be all right. That's how it worked. When Ikariam set out, Ublala collected up the useful sack he'd found, shouldered it, and went to join the warrior. Ralata caught up a short time later, just before Ikariam happened to glance at the pottery fragment Ublala had taken out to admire again, and then halted to face one last time the low hill they'd left behind. Ikariam frowned and was silent. Ublala was ready to turn away when Ikariam said,
Friend? I have remembered something.
Epilogue 1. Perched upon the stones of a bridge, the soldiers had the eyes of ravens. Their weapons hung black as talons. Their eyes gloried in the smoke of murder. To the shock of iron-heeled sticks, I drew closer in the cripple's bitter patience, and before them I finally tottered, grasping to capture my elusive breath. With the cockerel and swift of their knowing, they watched and waited for me. "I have come," said I, "from this road's birth. I have come," said I, "seeking the best in us." The sergeant among them had red in his beard, glistening wet as he showed his teeth. "There are few roads on this earth," said he, "that will lead you to the best in us, old one." "But you have seen all the tracks of men," said I, "and where the mothers and children have fled before your advance. Is there naught among them that you might set an old man upon?" The surgeon among this rook had bones under her vellum skin like a maker of limbs. "Old one," said she, "I have dwelt in the heat of chests, among heart and lungs, and slid like a serpent between muscles, swum the currents of slowing blood, and all these roads lead into the darkness where the broken will at last rest. Dare say I," she went on, "there is no place waiting inside where you might find in slithering exploration of mysteries all that you so boldly call the best in us." And then the man with shovel and pick, who could raise fort and berm in a day, timbered of thought and measured in all things, set the gauge of his eyes upon the sun, and said, "Look not in temples proud, or in the palaces of the rich high-born. We have raised each in turn in our time to melt gold from icon and shrine. And of all the treasures weeping in fire, there was naught but the smile of greed and the thick power of possession. Know then this, all roads before you, from the beginning of the ages past and those now upon us, yield no clue to the secret equations you seek, for each was built of bone and blood, and the backs of the slave did bow to the labored sentence of a life in chains of dire need and little worth. All that we build one day echoes hollow. Where then, good soldiers, will I ever find all that is best in us, if not in flesh or in temple bound or wretched road of cobbled stone?" "Could we answer you," said the sergeant, "this blood would cease its fatal flow, and my surgeon could seal wounds with a touch, all labors will ease before temple and road." "Could we answer you," said the sergeant, "crows might starve in our company, and our talons we would cast in bogs for the gods to fight over as they will. But we have not found in all our years the best in us until this very day." "How so?" asked I, "so lost now on the road." And said he, "Upon this bridge we sat since the dawn's bleak arrival, our perch of despond so weary and worn. And you we watched, at first a speck upon the strife-painted horizon, so tortured in your tread as to soak our faces in the wonder of your will. Yet on you came, upon two sticks so bowed in weight, seeking, say you, the best in us. And now we have seen in your gift the best in us. And were treasures at hand, we would set them humbly before you, a man without feet who walked a road." Now soldiers with kind words are rare enough, and I welcomed their regard as I moved among them, cross the bridge and onward to the long road beyond. I travel seeking the best in us, and one day it shall rise before me to bless this journey of mine, and this road I began upon long ago shall now end where waits for all the best in us. Where ravens perch. Avas Didion Flicker. This had, in the end, been a war of liberation. Colancy citizens had emerged from the city, and after 5 days of hard labor, the vast trenches, revetments, and redoubts had been transformed into long barrows. Three such barrows now stood to mark the Battle of Blessed Gift, where the Lethary, Balcando, Gilk, and Teblor had fought the army of Brother Diligence. And at the foot of the fissured ruin of the spire, three large barrows of raw earth rose to commemorate the fallen Imas, Jaghut, Kachain Chimal, and Colansi, with one smaller mound holding the remains of two Malazans. And it was at this last place that figures now gathered. Remaining at a respectful distance, close to the now abandoned work camps of the diggers, Lord Nimanda stood with Korlat and his uncle, Silchas Ruin. Along with Skintik and Desra and Apsalara, they had accompanied the troops commanded by Captain Fiddler on this long, tedious journey to the coast. It was not hard to mourn the death of brave men and women, nor even reptilian soldiers bred for war. There was no shame in the tears that ran from Nimanda's face when he came to learn of the slaughter of the Imas in the moment of their rebirth. The survivors had departed some days ago now, into the north, seeking their leader, he had been told, whose fate after the battle remained unknown. And the brother of his father, standing now at his side, had grieved over the destruction of an old friend, Tulas Shorn, in the draconic War of Awakening. The sword strapped to Silchas Ruin's hip still held bound to its blade the souls of three surviving Elaint from Korald Emerlan. The details of this binding were still unclear to Nimanda, and his uncle seemed to be a man of few words. More rain threatened from the east, and Nimanda watched the dark grey wall of clouds drawing ever closer. He glanced over at Korlat. Something had awakened her own grief, and it had struck deep in the Sister of Cold Nights. And as the distant figures now closed about the small barrow, he saw her take a half step forward and then halt. "Korlat," said Nimanda. She caught herself, turned to him, wretched eyes.
"Lord?"
"It is not our place to intrude upon them at this time."
"I understand."
"But I believe it is nevertheless fitting that we convey our respect and honour in some fashion. I wonder, could I ask you, Sister of Cold Nights, to represent us by attending their ceremonies on our behalf?" Something was released from her face, suddenly softening it, awakening once more her extraordinary beauty. She bowed to him.
"Lord, I shall go at once."
Nimanda watched her make her way towards the ceremony. Beside him, Silchas Ruin said, "She was ever favored by your father, Lord." "Silchas, she gave her heart to a human, a Malazan, who died in the conquest of Black Coral." The white-skinned man was silent for a moment and then said, "He must have been formidable."
"I imagine so."
"My experience with these Malazans has thus far been brief. I recognize the uniforms from my attempt on Letharas. To say that they have earned my respect is something of an understatement. I would not willingly cross them again." Nimanda looked at his uncle, wondering. Tentative, weakened by a sudden feeling of temerity, Korlat's steps slowed when she was still 40 or more paces away from the gathering of dignitaries. Off to her left, assembled in formation, stood the ranks of Malazans, the army known by the name of Bone Hunters. Beyond them, arrayed on a higher vantage point, were the far more numerous ranks of the second Malazan army, the host. To her right, where the Kachain Chimal had encamped, the Vagath and Kel hunters had formed up in a facing line, the matron foremost among them. A human woman was walking out from that formation on a route that would intersect Korlat's own. Perhaps she would find strength in that company. Failing that, she doubted she would manage to get much closer. Her heart felt laid bare. She had believed her days of deepest grief were past, but seeing those Malazan marines, seeing Hedge, Quick Ben, and Kalam, had cut her open all over again. When they had seen her, when at last Nimanda had judged it time to approach that fated barrow, they had but nodded in greeting, and she could admit now that the distance they had maintained since had hurt her in some way. Perhaps they thought that she had been intent on stealing their sergeant away from them. Perhaps, even, they blamed her for his death. She did not know, and now she had been commanded to join them once more, at this place where two Malazan Marines were interred. She had selected a polished jet stone from her modest collection, knowing how the humans would smile at that. These small leather bags that Tist Andi always carried, with a stone to mark each gift of the owner's heart. She possessed but a few, one for Anamanda Rake, one for her fallen brother, Orphantal, one for Spinnok Durav, who cared nothing for her low birth, and one for Whiskey Jack. Soon, she had begun to suspect, she would set out to find two more, for Queen Yan Tovis, for Lord Nimanda. These stones were not to be surrendered. To give one up was to set down a love, to walk away from it forevermore. But it had been foolish finding a stone for a man whose love she had known for so brief a time. He had never felt the way she had. He could not have. She had gone too far, had given up too much. They'd not possessed the time to forge something eternal. Then he had died. And it was as if he had been the one doing the walking away, leaving his own stone behind, a dull, lifeless thing that was her heart.
The dead forget us, so said Galan. The dead forget us, and this is why we fear death.
She had thought, there on that distant barrow now called the Awakening, a whisper of something, a presence arriving old and achingly familiar. As if he had looked upon her, as if she had felt his eyes.
No, you foolish woman, it was his soldiers gathered on that hill. If he was there at all, it was for them.
Her thoughts were interrupted by the arrival of the woman from the Kachane Jamal ranks. Korlat had come to a halt with her memories, and now she looked on the stranger, offering a rueful half-smile.
My courage fails, she said.
The human woman, plain, past her youth, studied her for a moment.
What is that?
She asked.
In your hand?
Korlat thought to hide it away again, but then sighed and showed the black stone.
I thought a gift for the barrow. I have seen such practices before. Did you know them?
After a moment, Korlat turned to retrace her steps.
No, I am sorry. I did not.
But the woman took her arm.
Walk with me, then, and I will tell you about Mortal Sword Gessler and Shield Anvil Stormy. I was presumptuous. I doubt it,
the woman replied.
But you can hold on to your tale, if you like. I am Kalith.
Korlat gave her own name.
They won free the heart of the crippled god, said Kalith as they drew closer. But that is not how I remember them. They were stubborn. They snapped at each other like dogs. They mocked their own titles, told each other lies. They told me lies, too. Wild stories of their adventures. Ships on seas of fire, dragons and headless Tist Andi, whatever they are.
Korlat turned at that, thought to speak, then decided to remain silent.
In the time I knew them,
Kalith went on, not noticing her companion's reaction.
They pretty much argued without surcease. Even in the middle of terrible battle, they bickered back and forth. And all the while, these two Malazans, they did all that needed to be done, each and every time.
She nodded towards the spire.
Up there, she said, they climbed through walls of fire. And at that moment I realized that all those wild tales they told me, they were probably all true. Stormy died on the stairs, keeping a wild witch away from the heart. Those flames he could not in the end defeat. Gessler, we are told, died saving the life of a dog.
She pointed.
That one, Korlat, the one guarding the barrow's entrance. See how they await me now. It is because I am the only one the dog will let pass into the chamber. I dragged Gessler's body in there myself.
When the woman at her side stopped talking then, Korlat looked down and saw how her face had crumpled. With her own words, as if their meaning only now struck true. She very nearly collapsed, would have done so if not for Korlat's arm, now flexing to take the woman's weight. Kalith righted herself.
I am sorry. I did not mean... Oh, look at me.
I have you,
Korlat said. They went on. This side of the small round barrow, the group of humans parted before them, as many eyes on Korlat as on Kalith. She saw Hedge there, along with Quick Ben and Callum, and the grey-bearded man she now knew to be Fiddler, Whiskey Jack's closest friend. Their expressions were flat, and she weathered their regards with as much dignity as she could muster. Near them stood a mother and daughter, the latter, though little more than a child, pulling hard on a stick of rust leaf. And on this one's other side stood an older woman doing the same with her own, beside a handsome young man. She saw a white-faced Bargast chieftain grinning openly at herself, his desires made plain in the amused glint in his eyes. Just beyond Whiskey Jack's old squad stood a man and a woman, possibly siblings, in the company of an older man weighed down in the robes of a high priest, the gold silk patterned in the sinewy forms of serpents. Behind this group stood a man picking at his teeth, and beside him, seated on a stool, was an artist, sketching frantically on bleached lambskin with a wedge of charcoal. At his feet was a bloated toad. Arrayed in a semicircle around this group was an honor guard of some sort, facing outward, but as Korlat and Kalith approached, they smartly turned round, gauntleted hands lifting to their chests in salute, and she saw that they were the soldiers who had fought at the Awakening. Kalith leaned close against Korlat and disengaged her arm.
I believe there are burial gifts, she said, nodding to a soldier's chest, waiting beside the barrow entrance. I will take it inside.
She looked up at Korlat.
I will take your gift, Korlat, if you like.
She held up her hand, opened it to look at the gleaming stone in her hand. There was a commotion from Whiskey Jack's squad, and Korlat faced them, ready to retreat, to flee this place.
Captain,
snapped the plain woman behind the marines. Korlat saw that the squad had reached for their weapons, swords now half-drawn. At that woman's bark, they had halted their motions, and Korlat stared, frightened and dismayed by what she saw in their faces. The plain woman stepped round to place herself between Korlat and the squad. Standing directly in front of Fiddler, she said,
"What in Hood's name do you think you're doing?"
"Forgive us, adjunct," Fiddler replied, eyes still on Korlat.
"Explain yourselves! High Mage, Callum, one of you, speak!"
"Your pardon, adjunct," Fiddler ground out. "I would ask the Tistandi a question."
"By your threat,"
snapped the adjunct, turning to Korlat,
"should she refuse the courtesy, I will defend her decision."
Korlat shook her head, drawing a deep, fortifying breath.
"No, thank you, adjunct. This soldier was Whiskey Jack's closest friend. If he would ask me something, I shall answer as best I am able."
The adjunct stepped back. Fiddler's gaze fell to the stone in her hand.
"You mean to give that up? Did you know Gessler and Stormy?"
Korlat shook her head.
"Then why?"
Her thoughts fumbled, words failing her, and her eyes fell from Fiddler's.
"Is it his?"
She looked back up, startled. Behind Fiddler, the marines of the squad stared, but now she saw that what she had taken for rage in their expressions was in fact something else, something far more complicated.
"Korlat, is it his?"
She faced the barrow entrance.
"They were marines,"
she said in a weak voice.
"I thought a measure of respect."
"If you give that up, you will destroy him."
She met Fiddler's eyes and at last saw the raw anguish in them.
"I thought he left me."
"No, he hasn't."
Hedge spoke.
"He only found love once, Korlat. and we're looking at the woman he chose. If you give up that stone, we'll cut you to pieces and leave your bones scattered across half this world."
Khorlat stepped close to Fiddler.
"How do you know this?"
His eyes flickered, were suddenly wet.
"On the hill. His ghost. He saw you on the plain. He couldn't take his eyes off you. I see now you thought through Hood's gate, the old love's forgotten, drifting away. Maybe you even began questioning if it ever existed at all, or meant what you thought it meant. Listen, they've told me the whole story. Khorlat, he's waiting for you. And if he has to, he'll wait forever."
Her hand closed about the stone, and all at once the tension fell away, and she looked past Fiddler to the soldiers of the squad.
"You would have killed me for forsaking him," she said. "I am reminded of the man he was, to have won such loyalty among his friends."
Hedge said,
"You've got centuries. Well, who knows how long? Don't think he expects you to be celibate or anything. We ain't expecting that neither. But that stone, we know what it means to your kind. You just shocked us, that's all."
Khorlat slowly turned to the barrow.
"Then I should leave here, for I have nothing for these fallen soldiers."
The adjunct surprised her by stepping forward and taking her arm. She led her to the chest.
"Open it,"
she invited. Wondering, Khorlat crouched down, lifted back the lid. The chest was empty. Baffled, she straightened, met the adjunct's eyes, and saw a wry smile.
"They were marines. Everything of value they've already left behind. In fact, Khorlat of the Tist Andi, if Gessler and Stormy could, they'd be the first ones to loot their own grave goods."
"And then bitch about how cheap we were," Fiddler said behind them.
"We are here to see the barrow sealed," said the adjunct. "And if we can, get that Wiccan demon to yield before it starves to death."
1,000 paces away from this scene, a gathering of Jaghut warriors stood facing a barrow raised to embrace the fallen Imas. They were silent, as befitted the moment, a moment filled with respect and that bone-deep loss for comrades fallen in a battle shared, a time lived to the hilt, but for all that, it was a silence riotous with irony. After a time, a small creature looking like a burst pillow of rotted straw came up to lie down at the feet of one of the Jaghut. From the filthy tangle out came a lolling tongue. One of the warriors spoke.
"Varandas, our commander never tires of pets."
"Clearly," replied another. "He has missed us."
"Or does the once Lord of Death return with alarming appetites?"
"You raise disquiet in me," said Sanad.
"You promised to never speak of that. Oh, you mean my query on appetites. Humblest apologies, Sanad."
"She lies, Gathras. This I swear."
"The only one lying here is the dog, surely."
The warriors all stared down at the creature, and then roared with laughter. That went on and on, until Hood whirled round.
"Will you all shut up?"
In the sudden silence that followed, someone snorted. When Hood reached for the sword at his hip, his warriors all found somewhere else to look, until the ratty dog rose and lifted a leg. Weathering their raucous laughter and the steady stream tapping his ankle, Hood slowly closed his eyes.
"This is why Jaghut chose to live alone."
Bryce Bedict turned at the sound of distant laughter, squinted at the Jaghut warriors standing at the Amas barrow.
"Erenst nudge, but that's hardly fitting, is it?"
Aranicht frowned.
"Theirs is an odd humour, my love. I do not think disrespect is the intention. Indifference would have managed that succinctly enough. Instead,
They walked out there and requested solitude.
Ah, murmured Bryce, taking her hand. It is, I believe, time.
He led her towards the adjunct, where Queen Abrastel, Falash and Spax now joined Tavaray. Just beyond them, Aranict saw, was Ganos. Not one to join in these moments, yet never far from his sister. Bryce spoke as soon as they drew near.
There was some tension at the Barrow, adjunct. I trust all is well.
A misunderstanding, Prince.
The cattle dog.
No. Once the Barrow was sealed, the beast joined Destriant Callis, and at her side I believe it will stay until its life is done.
There is word, said Abrastel, of a tribe on the plateau north of Estebance, remote kin of Calith's Elan, Bedouin herders.
They will journey alone? Bryce asked in concern.
With only a few hundred Kel hunters as escort, yes, replied the Balkando queen.
Prince Bryce, said Falash, your brother the king's fleet is only days away.
Her languid gaze flicked to Aranict.
I've not yet told him, Aranict replied, lighting a stick. Beloved, she now said, your brother is with that fleet.
Tehol hates the sea. Are you certain of that?
But Falash was coughing, her eyes wide on the prince.
Excuse me, King Tehol hates the sea? But rather, I mean, forgive me, Bug, his... Oh, never mind. My pardon, Prince Bryce.
Abrastel was regarding her daughter sidelong.
You're as plump as you ever were, she said. Smoke more, girl.
Yes, mother, at once.
And where is your handmaid?
Down with Captain Elal, mother, ship-shaping a boat, or whatever they call it.
Bryce spoke to Tavaray.
Adjunct, there were times when I... Well, I doubted you. This seemed so vast, what you sought.
Forgive me for interrupting, Highness, Tavaray replied. The deeds that have won us this victory belong to every soul on this journey, and it has been a rather long journey. A sword's tip is nothing without the length of solid steel becking it.
She hesitated.
There have been many doubts to weather, but this is a weakness we all share.
You said you would be unwitnessed, yet that proved untrue, did it not?
She shrugged.
For each moment recorded in the annals of history, how many more are lost? Highness, we shall be forgotten. All of this, it will fade into the darkness, as all things will. I do not regret that.
In Letharas, said Bryce, there will be a statue of bronze raised in your likeness. I know few will know what it means, what it signifies, but I will, adjunct.
A statue?
Tavaray cocked her head, as if considering the notion.
Will I be beautiful? She asked, and before Bryce could answer, she formally bowed before him and then Queen Abrastel. I thank you both for making my cause your own. For your losses, I grieve. Goodbye, Highnesses.
They let her depart, and only Aranict heard Bryce say,
Of course you will. A hood damned dog, muttered Deadsmell as the marines and heavies walked from the barrow.
That's Gessler for you, replied Throatslitter. Brainless to the end.
He wouldn't have liked things without Stormy anyway, observed Balm.
Bottle considered this brief exchange and then nodded to himself.
There's a point when there's nothing left to say, when every word does nothing more than stir the ashes.
He glanced over at Smiles, and then Corrick, and finally Tar.
We finally took some losses, our squad. Cuttle never thought he'd die, not like that. In some whore's bed, maybe. Korab, gods below, how that man could fight. Limp says he saw him, there at the end. He'd blown his knee again, was looking over at the crippled god. And there was Korab. His face all lit with the glory of his last stand over the chained body of a god. Really, what could be more perfect than that? Well done, Korab Bilan Senualis. Heard she's retiring us, ventured Cinta. Priests paying us out.
A damned fortune for each and every one of us.
We're in Faradin, eh? War between them?
To the families if they got any, Nep. That's how it's done. Stand or fall, you still get paid.
Ganirt Pavrim!
Cinta made a startled sound, and beside her, Kiswer leaned forward to shoot Nep Farrow a shocked look.
Really, Nep?
Kiswer asked.
Nepel!
Gods below, Cinta whispered.
I never...
Reaching the road, they came within sight of the Bone Hunter regulars. Glancing back, Bottle saw the adjunct on her way up, with Banaskar at her side. Behind these two walked Lastari Yil, Henar Vygolf, the Three Fists, Scannero and Ruthen Gud.
She wants a last word with them,
Tar said, evidently noticing Bottle's backward look.
But we're not going to be there for that. Between her and them, you others all hear that? We walk through.
We walk through,
Helion echoed.
Crump, go back and help Limp. He's lagging. Let's just get this over with.
They strode into the loose ranks of the regulars.
Wish we had it as easy as you did,
someone shouted. Korik yelled back.
You never would have hacked it, Fan.
Hey, Helion, found me this big spider here. Wanna see it?
Call it whatever you want, soldier. It's still small.
Bottle shook his head.
Oh, fuck. They're soldiers. What did you expect?
It was dark by the time Korlat returned to the small Tist-Andi camp. They were seated round a fire, like hunters out from the wood, or harvesters at day's end. A fresh rain had cleansed the air, but its passage had been brief, and now overhead tracked the jade strangers, as she had learned to call them, casting down a green light. Nimanda looked up, made room for her on the Kalansi workbench they had found in one of the work camps.
We were wondering if you would ever return, he said.
She drew her cloak about her shoulders.
I watched the bone hunters depart, she said.
Have ships arrived, then?
Korlat shook her head.
They're moving to a camp at this end of the Esteban's Valley. The adjunct spoke to her regulars. She thanked them. That and nothing more. She was the last to leave. She bade the others go ahead, even her brother, and she walked alone. There was something... something...
She shook her head.
It broke my heart.
A voice spoke from the darkness behind her.
She does that, does Tavare.
They turned to see Fiddler stepping into the firelight, carrying something wrapped in skins. Behind, arrayed but drawing no closer, Korlat saw the rest of Whiskey Jack's old squad. They seemed to be muttering to each other in low tones, and then Quick Ben pointed up past the road, and in a sharp voice said,
There, that hilltop! Not too far, but far enough. Well?
He looked at his companions, and both men grunted their assent. Returning her attention to Fiddler, she saw that he had been watching, and now he nodded. Faced Korlat.
It's not far. In this air, it'll carry just fine.
I'm sorry, said Korlat. What are you doing?
See the hill they indicated, other side of the road? Go there, Korlat.
Excuse me?
Nimanda made to rise, but a look from Fiddler stilled him.
Just her, he said. I'll take that stump there. Mind, sir?
Silchas Rowan, seated on that stump, rose, shaking his head, and then gesturing an invitation. Fiddler went over and settled down on it. He began unwrapping the object on his lap, and then looked up and met Korlat's eyes.
Why are you still here?
What are you going to do?
She demanded. He sighed.
Said it was the last time for him. Said it like it was an order. Well, he should know by now we're lousy with taking orders.
He slipped away the final layer of skin, revealing a fiddle and bow.
Go on now, Korlat. Oh, and tell him this one's called My Love Waits. I won't take credit for it. One of Fisher's.
Then he looked round at the gathered Tist-Andi.
There's another one that I can slide into it easily enough. A bit sadder, but not too sad.
It's from Anamandaris. You'll forgive me, please, if I get the title wrong. It's been a long time. Galan's Hope? Does that sound right to you all? Seems it does. Korlat backed away, felt a hand touch her shoulder. It was Hedge.
Hilltop, Korlat. Fed's gonna call him back. One more time. But listen, if it's too much, walk the other way or stay off the hill. He'll see you anyway. We're doing that bit no matter what. For him.
He would have babbled on, but she moved past him. Eyes on the hill on the other side of the road. Behind her, the strings drew a song into the night air. When she reached the road and saw her beloved standing on the hill before her, Korlat broke into a run. Epilogue 2. For once, the seas were calm on the beach below, and with the tide out, many of the Imas had ventured on to the flats to collect shellfish. Off to one side, the twins played with Absi, and the sound of the boy's laughter reached up to the shelf of stone where sat Udinas. He heard footsteps coming down the trail nearby and turned to see Onos and Hetan. They were carrying reed baskets to join in the harvest. Udinas saw Onos pause, look out towards the children.
"Relax, Onos," Udinas said. "I'll keep an eye on them."
The warrior smiled. Hetan took his hand to lead him down. Reclined on a high shelf of limestone above Udinas, Riad said,
"Stop worrying, father. It'll wear you out."
From one of the caves higher up the climb behind them, there drifted out the sound of a crying baby.
"Poor Seren. That's one cranky baby she has there."
"We're safe," Riad said. "And if some damned mob of vicious humans shows up, well, they'll have Kelava, Onrak, Onos Tulan, and me to deal with."
"I know," Udinas replied.
He rubbed and massaged his hands. The aches were coming back. Maybe it was time to try that foul medicine Lera Epar kept offering him.
"Ah, it's just years of cold water. Sinks in, that's all."
Glancing over, he grunted to his feet.
"Father?"
"It's all right," he said. "The twins have buried Absi up to his neck. Those girls need a good whipping."
"You've never whipped a child in your life."
"How would you know?" "Well, maybe I haven't, but the threat still works."
Riad sat up, looked down on Udinas with his young, sun-darkened face. Squinting, Udinas said,
"In the bright sun, I see your mother in your smile."
"She smiled?"
"Once, I think. But I won't take credit for it."
Udinas set off down to the beach. Absi had clambered free and tackled one of the girls and was now tickling her into a helpless state. Trouble passed, but he continued anyway. Out in the sea beyond the small bay, whales broached the surface, sending geysers into the air, announcing the coming of summer. The rider paused on the road, glancing down at the untended turnips growing wild in the ditch, and after a moment he kicked his horse onward. The sun was warm on his face as he rode west along Itko Khan's coastal track. In his wake, in the lengthening shadows, two figures took form. Moments later, huge hounds appeared. One bent to sniff at the turnips and then turned away. The figure with the cane sighed.
"Satisfied?"
The other one nodded.
"And you imagine only the best now, don't you?"
"I see no reason why not."
Shadow Throne snorted.
"You wouldn't."
Cotillion glanced over at him.
"Why not, then?"
"Old friend, what is this? Do you still hold to a belief in hope?"
"Do I believe in hope? I do."
"And faith?"
"And faith. Yes, I believe in faith."
Neither spoke for a time, and then Shadow Throne looked over at the hounds and cocked his head.
"Hungry, are we?"
Bestial heads lifted, eyes fixing on him.
"Don't even think it, Amirnas."
"Why not?
Remind that fop on the throne who's really running this game.
Not yet.
Where's your impatience? Your desire for vengeance? What sort of patron of assassins are you?
Cotillion nodded down the road. Leave them alone. Not here. Not now. Shadow Throne sighed a second time.
Misery guts!
The shadows dissolved and a moment later were gone, leaving nothing but an empty road. The sun set, dusk closing in. He'd yet to pass any traffic on this day, and that was a little troubling, but he rode on. Having never been this way before, he almost missed the sidetrack leading down to the settlement on the shelf of land above a crescent beach, but he caught the smell of wood smoke in time to slow up his mount. The beast carefully picked its way down the narrow pass. Reaching the bottom, now in darkness, he reined in. Before him was a small fishing village, though it looked mostly abandoned. He saw a cottage nearby, stone-walled and thatch-roofed, with a stone chimney from which smoke drifted in a thin grey stream. An area of land had been cleared above and behind it, where vegetables had been planted, and working still in the growing gloom was a lone figure. Crocus dismounted, hobbled the horse outside an abandoned shack to his left, and made his way forward. It should not have taken long, yet by the time he reached the verge of the garden, the moon overhead was bright, its effervescent light glistening along her limbs, the sheen of her black hair like silk as she bent to gather up her tools. He stepped between rows of bushy plants, and she turned, watched him walk up to her. Crocus took her face in his hands, studied her dark eyes. "I never liked that story," he said.
"Which one?" she asked.
"The lover, lost on the moon, tending her garden alone."
"It's not quite like that, the story, I mean."
He shrugged. "It's what I remember from it. That and the look in your eyes when you told it to me. I was reminded of that look a moment ago."
"And now?"
"I think," he said, "the sadness just went away, Apsalar."
"I think," she replied, "you are right."
The boy watched the old man come down to the pier, as he did almost every day whenever the boy happened to be lingering along the waterfront at around this time, when the morning was stretching towards noon and all the fish were asleep. Day after day he'd seen the old man carrying that silly bucket with the rope tied to the handle for the fish he never caught, and the fishing rod in his other hand would most likely snap in half at a crab's tug. Bored, as he was every day, the boy ambled down to stand on the edge of the pier, to look out on the few ships that bothered sheltering in the harbour of Malaz City. So he could dream of the worlds beyond, where things exciting and magical happened, and heroes won the day and villains bled out in the dirt. He knew he was nobody yet, not old enough for anything. Trapped here where nothing ever happened and never would. But one day he would face the whole world, and, why, they'd all know his face, they would. He glanced over to where the old man was sitting down, legs over the edge, working bait onto the hook.
"You won't never catch nothing," the boy said, idly pulling at a rusty mooring ring. "You sleep in too late every day."
The old man squinted at the hook, adjusted the foul-smelling bait.
"Late nights," he said.
Where you go? I know all the taverns and bars in the whole harbour district."
"Do you know?"
"All of them. Where do you drink, then?"
"Who said anything about drinking, lad? No, what I do is play."
The boy drew slightly closer.
"Play what?"
"Fiddle."
"You play at a bar?"
"I do, aye."
"Which one?"
"Smiley's."
The old man ran out the hook on its weighted line and leaned over to watch it plummet into the depths. The boy studied him suspiciously.
"I ain't no fool," he said.
The old man glanced over, nodded.
"I can see that."
"Smiley's doesn't exist. It's just a story, a haunting. People hearing things, voices in the air, tankards clunking, laughing.
That's all they hear in the night air, lad?
The boy licked his suddenly dry lips.
No, they hear fiddling, music. Sad, awful sad.
Hey, no, not all of it's sad, though maybe that's what leaks out. But, and he grinned at the boy, I wouldn't know that, would I?
You're like all the rest, the boy said, facing out to sea once again.
Who are all the rest, then?
Making up stories and stuff, lying. It's all anybody ever does here, 'cause they got nothing else to do. They're all wasting their lives, just like you. You won't catch any fish, ever.
And he waited to gauge the effect of his words.
Who said I was after fish?
The old man asked, offering up an exaggeratedly sly expression.
What, crabs? Wrong pier. It's too deep here. It just goes down and down and forever down.
Aye, and what's down there at the very bottom? You ever hear that story?
The boy was incredulous and more than a little offended.
Do I look 2 years old? That demon, the old emperor's demon. But you can't fish for it.
Why not?
Well, your rod would break. Look at it.
Looks can be deceiving, lad. Remember that.
The boy snorted. He was always getting advice.
I won't be like you, old man. I'm going to be a soldier when I grow up. I'm going to leave this place forever. A soldier fighting wars and getting rich and fighting and saving people and all that.
The old man seemed about to say one thing, stopped, and instead said,
Well, the world always needs more soldiers.
The boy counted this as a victory, the first of what he knew would be a lifetime of victories. When he was grown up and famous.
That demon bites and it'll eat you up. And even if you catch it and drag it up, how will you kill it? Nobody can kill it.
Never said anything about killing it, the old man replied. Just been a while since we last talked.
Ha! 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 Ha!
High above the harbour, the winds were brisk coming in from the sea. They struck and spun the old battered weather vane on its pole, as if the demon knew not where to turn. A sudden gust took it then, wrenched it hard around, and with a solid squeal the weather vane jammed. The wind buffeted it, but decades of decay and rust seemed proof.